This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's Ascensus.com.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Jay Powell leads the program today in exactly five words. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today, November the 1st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Fed Chair Jay Powell used 7,561 words in his post-meeting press conference today, talking about this economy, where the central bank thinks it's going, and how he and his colleagues are thinking about interest rates. Of those 7,561 words, five rise to the top. We shall take them one by one. Here you go.
Inflation remains well above our...
Inflation, it is simply too high for the Fed's liking, and Powell says they're going to keep on doing what it takes to get it to their target, 2%. No surprise there. Next.
Monetary policy.
Monetary policy is the fancy Fed way of saying interest rates, which aligns closely with...
Clearly restrictive at 5.25.
Restrictive, which you can take to mean designed to slow the economy down. Here it is. In a sentence, that might help. The central bank will keep policy restrictive to bring inflation down to its target of 2%. Okay, next.
Is the labor market continuing?
As in the labor market, the thing Powell and company have been trying and trying and trying to get to cool off with all of their rate hikes the past year and a half. We get an update Friday, by the by, with the October unemployment report. Okay, finally, now for what Jay Powell is thinking in exactly five words.
The risk is that.
Risk. This is the whole smash for the Fed right now. The risk that if they take their foot off the economic brake, if you will, that restrictive policy stance, inflation is going to pick back up. Powell went for an hour in his press conference today. We did it in a minute and a half. There you go. Elsewhere in American capitalism, by which I mean the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, with the Fed summarily dispatched, we are going to turn now to something called the quarterly refunding statement. Basically, the Treasury Department telling the world today how much debt, how many billions of dollars worth of bonds it is going to need to issue to keep the U.S. government up and running. $776 billion in new borrowing through the quarter, $112 billion in bonds next week, says Treasury. Demand for those bonds is going to dictate the yield that they pay. And the yield that those bonds pay is going to affect rates on mortgages and car loans and a whole lot of other stuff. It is a big, complicated machine, the debt market is. We talk about it all the time. But the thing is, the buyers for those bonds, well, it's just not who it used to be. And that matters a lot in this economy right now. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
All types of institutions buy U.S. Treasuries because they're still a safe asset. Banks, foreign governments, pension funds. But amongst those buyers, over the last decade or so, there's been one 500-pound gorilla, or a $4.9 trillion gorilla, if you measure by the amount of treasuries it still owns.
It's the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Brandon Swenson is a bond specialist at Blue Bay Asset Management. The Fed started buying U.S. debt after the Great Recession and then lots more after COVID to stimulate the economy, aka quantitative easing. But because of inflation, the Fed now wants to slow down the economy. So it basically stopped buying treasuries last year, aka quantitative tightening.
A mechanism that they are relying on to tighten monetary policy and hopefully bring inflation back down to that 2% target.
The Fed isn't the only big buyer bowing out of the treasury market. Major U.S. banks are also buying less than they used to. In the wake of the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, many are struggling with a smaller deposit base and just have less money to invest, says Marvin Lowe at State Street.
They need to reduce some of the asset side of their businesses, and they're looking at doing it by slowing and reducing their overall treasury holdings.
Some foreign governments like China have also curtailed their treasury purchases recently. All told, less demand means higher bond yields, and interest on the 10-year T-note is still flirting with 16-year highs. But there's a new opportunistic buyer that has stepped into the picture, hedge funds. Daryl Duffy is an economist at Stanford.
Hedge funds indeed have been taking large speculative positions in U.S. treasuries, now on the order of $2 trillion. They're one of the largest groups of owners.
Duffy says interest rates might be even higher if not for hedge funds, but their unregulated presence may lead to unwanted volatility in what should be the safest, most liquid bond market in the world. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Okay, here's a sort of work-related PSA. Nobody reads your emails. All right, not nobody, but there's a good chance that plenty of people who you might think read them don't. Nearly half of workers say they've missed important deadlines and meetings because they don't pay enough attention to their inboxes. Now, mind you, this data comes from Slack, the work chat platform that benefits from people using its service instead of email. Still, and although this gets to something bigger going on in the workplace, especially in the increasingly digital, increasingly remote workplace. Between email and Zoom, Teams and Slack and whatnot, all the alerts can be overwhelming and can actually make us less productive. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at how, in the search to streamline communication, we have created chaos.
At some point a couple years ago, Susan Hoy felt like she was being buried alive under a pile of texts, emails, and chats. Every morning, she'd wake up at 4:30, open her eyes, grab her phone, and from her bed, while it was still dark, she'd scroll through the messages.
I had a lot coming at me all the time between emails and chatting on the team channel and our software program. I just couldn't get through all of it in a day.
Hoy owns a small business called Nevada Guardian Services in Las Vegas. Basically, it's an agency that helps manage the lives of people who can't manage themselves, people who are sick, dealing with memory loss, or struggle with severe mental health challenges, which means she's constantly juggling conversations with attorneys, physicians, family members, and employees.
Most of our job is communication. It absolutely is.
But ever since her workplace went hybrid, the number of messages grew, and they were coming at her from a bunch of different platforms. It created a lot of anxiety, and not just for her, but also for her employees.
Literally, I have a staff member who would come into my office and say, "Did you see that email I just sent you?" Like, no, I did not. there was this lack of this trust.
Also, a lack of concentration. In the last 20 years, our attention span at work has drastically shrunk from 2.5 minutes to less than 50 seconds as we bounce from spreadsheets to Zoom to Slacks. That's according to Gloria Mark, who wrote Attention Span, a book about work in the digital age. She says these platforms have increased productivity, but they can also get in the way.
Electronic communications have expanded the scope of work. So it's given us additional work above and beyond other duties that we have.
More messages means more time responding and less time doing important tasks. She says that's become an exponentially bigger problem with remote work, because when you need to talk to someone, you can't see them. There are no physical cues, like someone closing their office door or wearing headphones, to signal they're busy.
You never know when to interrupt people. And so we interrupt others at a time that suits us.
Maybe because we're not aware of the moment, or because we're sort of information dumping so we can check to-dos off our lists, or because since no one sees us working, we want to tell them we are.
And this might be manifest by sending additional emails or additional Slack messages.
Of course, these platforms aren't going anywhere. So how do we get from that meme, this meeting could have been an email, to efficiency? Ellen Fay is a productivity coach in Florida.
Put your phone across the room. Turn off your email. Turn off all your notifications.
Fay says, yeah, you might not be able to control the fact that your boss is a chaotic communicator, but you don't have to be. For instance, Fay says, instead of impulsively slacking a coworker, keep a list of updates to give them all at once.
And then what I have seen is once one person does that in the organization, it kind of has a ripple effect.
That's how things worked for Susan Hoy in Nevada. She started a no-inter-office email policy. Inboxes are now only for communicating with people outside the business. Everything else happens in Microsoft Teams.
I had to really retrain my thought process that nobody needs a response from me on an email while I'm laying in bed.
She says it's cut her inbox down to 40 emails a day. The average worker gets around 120. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Here's a notification you should not turn off. The day's business and economic news from David Brancaccio and the gang at the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today that WeWork could be seeking bankruptcy Chapter 11 protection as soon as next week. The company became known first for its stylish and oh-so-popular co-working spaces, and then second, but much more spectacularly, for its implosion ahead of an initial public offering that had been planned for 2019 at a valuation of $47 billion. So perhaps the question is not why it's filing, but what took so long? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
The story of WeWork's meteoric rise and equally dramatic fall has spawned think pieces, podcasts, documentaries, and a prestige TV show, We Crashed, starring Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway.
WeWork's role is to elevate the world's consciousness.
All you have is me.
Professor Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan has taught WeWork as a case study in business classes.
I think there are two sort of surprise miracles here. One, that this company was able to get so big to begin with, and two, that it has survived on fumes all these years.
Really, he says, it's survived on the giant pile of cash it got from investors like SoftBank. In 2019, WeWork scrapped its IPO and ousted its now famously eccentric founder, Adam Neumann. It then restructured and did go public in 2021 through a merger with a special purpose acquisition company.
And here's the company's pitch. We've got some adults in the room now, and it's a new company.
But he says WeWork's business model has always been shaky, and it's only gotten shakier since COVID came along to weaken the commercial real estate market, says Jeffrey Havsey at Moody's Analytics.
WeWork has its own set of challenges compared to some of the other flexible office space providers.
Namely, expanding too fast, signing scores of long-term leases it later couldn't afford. Jamie Hodari, head of WeWork competitor Industrious, says his company does it differently, mostly partnering with building owners to manage flexible office space rather than lease it out.
One of the great ironies of this moment is that the flex market, pretty much everywhere in the world, is having record performance.
That's because many employers are rethinking their permanent offices and using more flexible space. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
equity, justice, and basic human rights.
Can't argue with that, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 221 points today, two-thirds of 1%, 33,274. The NASDAQ jumped 210 points, 1.6%, closed at 13,061. The S&P 500 increased 44 points, 1%, 42.37. Megan McCarty-Carino was just telling us about WeWork and its potential bankruptcy filing. Well, the market really believes it. The company stock plunged just under 47% today. Today marks both All Saints Day and Dia de los Muertos, and it might be interesting to look at some publicly traded companies connected to memorializing and burying the dead. Carriage Services operates funeral home facilities and gravesites, down 1.9% today. Matthews International Corporation, which has a division providing granite tombstones and systems for crematoria, down 0.8%. Security National Financial Corporation, which offers burial insurance and manages several cemeteries and mortuaries, basically flat today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are, of course, appeals yet to come, but it's entirely possible the future of the American residential real estate economy was decided in a federal courthouse in Kansas City this week. A jury found the National Association of Realtors and a couple of the bigger real estate brokerage companies conspired to artificially pump up commissions that are paid to real estate agents. The jury also found them liable for fines to the tune of $1.8 billion. Marketplace's Henry Epp has more now on what it's all going to mean.
Right now, if you sell your home through a real estate agent, that person collects a fee, usually about 5 or 6% of the sale price, and then typically splits it with the agent for the buyer. A lot of the rules around this process are set by the National Association of Realtors, says Ryan Tomasello, managing director at the investment firm KBW.
This whole securitist process results in a significant lack of transparency for consumers around how commissions are set, how they're paid, and the ability that consumers have to negotiate them.
The Missouri jury found that the Realtors Association conspired with major brokerages to keep those fees high.
The odd thing about the way real estate brokers' fee works is that they're not really tied to the effectiveness of an individual agent.
Jenny Schutz is a senior fellow at Brookings. She says right now, buyer's agents typically get a flat fee, whether they do a good job or not. If that changes...
This is bad news for the agents that have been essentially getting subsidized, that aren't providing consumers with 3% worth of consumer value, but have been getting paid more than they're really worth.
Now, buyers could have more power to negotiate lower fees, says Susan Wachter, a professor at the Wharton School of Business.
But it doesn't mean that buyers would necessarily pay less for the property.
She thinks the tight supply of housing will keep prices high. The ruling could also endanger the National Association of Realtors' multiple listing service for real estate, Wachter says.
The buyer would need to go to several different services to get a sense of what's in the market as a whole.
And this isn't the only lawsuit out there challenging the NAR's dominance. More are coming, and federal regulators are watching too, says KBW's Ryan Tomasello.
Regardless of the means by which this plays out, the end game is pretty clear, that this current structure will be completely upended.
So all you real estate agents out there, brace yourselves. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
We're having, as you've probably heard by now, not just chronic drought out here in the American West, the occasional rainy season notwithstanding. We're having what climate scientists call aridification, a long-term, a very long-term trend toward dryness, basically. So the increasingly scarce amount of water that we do have out here is becoming all the more valuable for everyone. 30 tribal nations in the Colorado River Basin are entitled by treaty to at least a quarter of that river's flows, but they've been shut out of management decisions about the river for more than 100 years. Now, though, those tribes do see a chance to reclaim their seat at the table. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has been reporting on this for our podcast, How We Survive.
Albuquerque, New Mexico is about 200 miles away from the Colorado River, but most of the water that sustains it comes from the Colorado. To explain how, Daryl V. Hill, former water administrator for the Jicarilla Apache Nation, drove me out to the eastern edge of the reservation.
Kazotea Tunnel Outlet.
Isn't that pretty wild? Wow. So yeah, 90,000 acre feet of water.
That's how much water moves through the Azotea Tunnel every year. The federal government paid for its construction in the 1960s. The tunnel snakes underneath 26 miles of rugged mountain across the Continental Divide and delivers Colorado River water into the Rio Grande system.
Somebody taking a shower today in Albuquerque.
Or fishing in the Rio Chama, or irrigating a chili crop in Socorro.
This is where their water's coming from.
Today, 70% of Albuquerque's drinking water passes through this tunnel. It was a huge victory for the city. But to deliver that victory, the federal government diverted Colorado River water out of Indian Country without consulting the tribal nations who would become water insecure as a result. Vigil says this is a familiar story, going back over 100 years in the basin.
There was a group of men meeting at Bishop's Lodge in 1922 to set the water future for the Colorado River. Well, my people were barely surviving on government rations.
He's talking about the Colorado River Compact. There are these old-timey black and white photos from its signing. A bunch of stone-faced white guys in suits huddled around a desk at Bishop's Lodge in Santa Fe, dividing up the river's flows between each of the seven states in the Colorado River Basin. The 30 tribal nations with claims to the river weren't invited,
because there was a view that they weren't going to continue to exist into the future.
Heather Whiteman runs him is a professor at the University of Arizona School of Law.
The belief was that, you know, there wasn't a need to secure and preserve their rights.
But tribal nations did survive federal assimilation policy. And over the last several decades, many have put up legal cases for their Colorado River water rights and won. Still, Whiteman Runs Him says tribes are living with the consequences of short-sighted management decisions they never had a say in.
It is frustrating that at the time when tribes have finally secured access to the resources needed to pursue a role in the processes, that now we're presented with this environmental catastrophe that is no fault of the tribes.
The current guidelines for managing the river during this catastrophic drought don't include tribal nations, just the seven basin states and the federal government. But they expire at the end of 2025.
I'm very optimistic that the 2026 guidelines are going to have inclusion of the indigenous voice.
Lorelei Cloud is vice chairman of the Southern Ute Indian Tribe and one of the tribal leaders pushing for formal inclusion in this next set of guidelines.
You have the United States government, you have each state being represented. Those are all sovereigns. So you have 30 sovereigns within that respective area, so they also should be included.
The worst drought in 1,200 years is tearing up the rulebook in the Colorado River Basin. And for the first time, Daryl Vigil says the federal government is receptive to tribes having meaningful decision-making power.
You know, hydrology has pushed us to the conversation of equity, justice, and basic human rights. We have the opportunity to set some of that straight here in the basin with these post-2026 guidelines.
Once they're at the table, he says tribal nations will bring ancestral knowledge and innovations that can help the entire basin learn to live with less water. In the Jicarilla Apache Nation, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Savannah and Marketplace's Amy Scott have lots more about water and the changing climate on our podcast, How We Survive. A new episode is out today, by the way. Platform of your choice, of course. This final note on the way out, just to close the loop on that Jay Powell press conference today. It was, as it should have been, 99% economic policy, about 1% geopolitics in response to a question. Here is Powell on the Middle East.
It isn't clear at this point that the conflict in the Middle East is on track to have significant economic effects. That doesn't mean it isn't incredibly important and something for people to take great, really important notice of, but it may or may not turn out to be something that matters for the Federal Open Market Committee as an economic body.
All right, we got to go. Here, of course, is your moment of economic context before we depart. The rare instance where correlation may actually be causation. Toyota announced today it's going to raise hourly wages for its top-paid non-union U.S. workers, 9% starting 1 January. The causal factor here, of course, is clearly the UAW strike that is so close to being over. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.